Apologize for the delay. So the second case on today's oral argument calendar is number 822-494, In Re Estate of Raymond DeForest Trahan, which involves the two parties are the estate, the personal representative of the estate, and Rice County. Oral argument is set for 10 minutes after 10, which is only 1 minute for now. I think we will proceed. I assume both counsel are aware of our typical procedures. Each party will have 15 minutes for its initial argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. We do have a time clock, which you should be able to see on your screen if you're using the gallery view or the like. And so you should be able to see your remaining time. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your clients and then present your argument.
Good morning. May it please the panel. My name is Sean McCarthy. I'm an assistant Rice County attorney, and I appear today on behalf of appellant Rice County. The trial court below applied the wrong law and reached the wrong result. This is a legal question that is subject to de novo review by this court. The key here is that respondent, the estate, has no legal basis to stand on in terms of this unauthorized raid on the public treasury. And in fact, the generic concept of due process that was employed by the estate and the trial court in its decisions is not the appropriate law. As I'll develop a little further here, the appropriate law, the more refined analysis, is not general due process, it's equitable estoppel as applied against the government. Before we get into the analysis,
Judge Smith, go ahead.
Yeah. It seems that the decision of the district court was based on the failure of the county to provide the information that the court requested. And it looks like the only thing that was received was basically a bill without any detail. Can you address that, please?
I would be happy to, Your Honor. This is a capitation payment. Important. This is an insurance premium. So what the county provided was the decedent applied for medical assistance. He was enrolled in that program. Through that program, the states and the county end up paying insurance premiums. What the trial court was asking for and the respondents, the estate was demanding was, well, we want to see how that matches up with the actual dollars spent. That's kind of like if you're buying a house, your bank that's giving you the mortgage, they don't want to know how much it costs to repair your roof. They just want to know what's your premium. And in fact, the statute 256B, which is the statute from which this entire medical assistance and medical assistance recovery flows, that focuses on what did the state pay towards medical assistance, not what did an individual doctor or medical system receive from the insurance company. Does that help address the or respond to the court's question, Your Honor?
Well, I'm not sure. You say that this was an insurance premium. So explain to me a little bit about how this works in terms of the county providing funding for this. They just pay a premium every month. Is that it?
Yes, that's exactly it. And Your Honor, to assist the court, appellant's addendum starting at AA7, that's the actual printout. That is the official record of every single dollar that was paid on behalf of these medical premiums for the decedent during his lifetime while he was receiving medical assistance. And Your Honor, I'm really glad you asked that question. I think the trial court was just as confused about what this is and what it amounts to. And the trial court's own order I would recommend that this panel, if it's at all confused about this itself, read the three trial court orders, not just the most recent one, but this is the third appeal we've had on this case. The earlier two orders leading up to this third appeal, if you sit and read those three orders in sequence, you will see, number one, the trial court didn't seem to understand the difference between insurance premiums, capitation payments, and actual dollar-for-dollar medical expenses.
Mr. McCarthy, isn't it true that at the first judicial proceeding before Judge Kajacob, the county did not put in any evidence about capitation payments? The county presented it as if it were a fee-for-service recovery. Isn't that true?
I wasn't the attorney at that stage.
Well, but whether you are the attorney or not, you're responsible for knowing the record of this case. And yes, the record of this case includes the first trial, if you call it a trial, before Judge Kajacob. And the county at that point put in one exhibit and no affidavits, no witnesses, and expected to be paid based upon that document that you've identified in the addendum without explaining capitation payments. In fact, I would, ask you to look at your district court memoranda and your appellate brief on the first appeal and see if the word capitation appears. Does it?
It does not, Your Honor. You are exactly right. Part of it, though, is we've been doing medical assistance estate recovery since the 1960s. It's been around for 60 plus years. It's a well-developed area of statutory and decisional law. And in fact, these records, the documents attached to the appellate's appendum A7, those 16, 17 pages that the court was just asking about, they are used in every single estate recovery case.
Okay, so isn't the question here, the district court on pages 3 and 4 of its order found and concluded that Mr. Trahan did not receive notice that he or his estate would be charged for the capitation payments made on his behalf. And in the respondent's brief, they cite a Massachusetts case, which I think is very similar to this case. And speaking for myself, I think its analysis is persuasive. You did not respond to that argument in your reply brief, but I want to give you a chance to do so now. I mean, why should we not follow the analysis of the Massachusetts court in that case? And is there any evidence in the record here that the county provided notice to Mr. Trahan before services were provided that it would recover from his estate after his death the capitation payments that were made on his behalf?
The direct answer to Your Honor's question is that Massachusetts case does not apply the concept of equitable estoppel as applied against the government. Higher burden than just generic due process.
Wait, why are you presenting an argument about equitable estoppel when the district court never invoked that doctrine?
Because, Your Honor, this court is bound and the Supreme Court is bound to apply the correct law, even if the trial court didn't apply the correct law or the parties failed to bring it forward. That's a well-established Minnesota Supreme Court exception to the issues in terms of we want to refine the arguments and use the right law.
Your argument is that equitable estoppel does not prevent the county from proving its case, but I think the question remains, did the county prove its case? Did the county provide notice? Medicaid is a matter of federal law, correct? Federal law applies. Your own witness, affiant, Geneva Finn, said that the state and the county is required to comply with the CMS regulations and that required to follow CMS instruction in its state recovery program. Our case law says that the state Medicaid manual applies, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so, and that manual requires that notice be given before services are provided, right? Notice that capitation payments will be sought against the estate, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and was notice given?
Yes.
Where? Where is it
in the
record?
I can't point to the record because this was from, I believe, 15 to 18 years ago when he applied. That part of the record is lacking. However, even if it wasn't given, it doesn't matter. A mistake by a government agent in failing to give notice is insufficient under the controlling law of equitable estoppel to prevent the government from pursuing the recovery. That's the whole point of the legal error here, Your Honor. The trial court was focused on, I think there was a factual error. Problem is, the law says the legal error is where we start. We need to have malfeasance to rise to the level where the government would be a stop from pursuing recovery here.
If the opposing party had invoked the doctrine of equitable estoppel, either as a claim or as a defense, then it might be relevant. But if the opposing party did not invoke it and the district court did not invoke it, I don't understand why it's relevant to your appellate argument. And even if it were relevant, I don't understand why it would be sufficient to absolve the county of a failure to give notice required by federal law.
Your Honor, the key to that is medical assistance recovery is a very specialized area of law. It's something not a lot of attorneys have practice in or have significant practice in. And in fact, it's easy to kind of get lost in that. The key here is the trial court applied equitable estoppel. It didn't call it equitable estoppel, but here's what the trial court did. The trial court said, using kind of generic due process analysis, trial court said that the decedent's due process rights were violated. He wasn't given notice, just like your honor said. And that lack of notice was so unfair that it stops the county. It's not fair to let the county recover the medical assistance benefits paid. The problem with that is when a party seeks to use fairness, seeks to use equity to stop the government from fulfilling what the legislature and the U.S. government have mandated that the county is required to do, the proper test is not generic due process. Oh, that's not fair. You can't do that. The proper test when you apply it against the government is equitable estoppel. And the standards from equitable estoppel start with number one, a mere mistake by a county employee is insufficient to prevent the government from doing its legislatively mandated duty.
But counsel, I think Judge Johnson is saying, why isn't this a, you know, statutory, straightforward, what is required by the manual and the statute in terms of notice case and not in necessarily an equities case?
Your Honor, what the court has just pointed out is another error by the trial court. Just because there's a requirement in the manual and the statute, there's no penalty. There is nothing in there that says, and if you don't give this notice, you can't pursue it. In due process analysis, the lack of a penalty means that you don't have to stop the government. And in fact, that's why the Minnesota Supreme Court in the equitable estoppel context has said, if you're going to try start, you know, using equitable estoppel concepts, fairness to stop the government, fairness and equity arguments to stop the government from doing its legislative duty, you have an extremely high burden to reach to show that it really fits this particular case because the government acted with malfeasance, not just a mistake or forgot to use a form, told somebody something wrong. And in fact, the cases established this really well. In Masaba, the government agent gave wrong tax advice. That did not rise to the level of affirmative misconduct or malfeasance to stop the government from acting. In the City of North Oaks case, the city official gave incorrect documentation, failed to properly review the building permit, gave no notice of the error to the person wanting to do the building, and then actually issued an improper building permit, and the person was still. Later on, they try to say, hey, you gave me all this stuff. You didn't warn me. Now you want me to undo what this shed that I've built? The court in Masaba or in City of North Oaks said, no, that is not the kind of malfeasance or bad conduct that prevents the government, that stops the government from taking its actions. What I'm kind of getting at here is the concept of equitable estoppel when applied against the government raises significant concerns about separation of powers because we would end up having the trial courts in the judicial branch ordering the executive branch to not do what the legislative branch says it's going to do. That's a highly unusual circumstance. We only use it sparingly when it reaches that true level of malfeasance. There's nothing in the record here to show that we have malfeasance. At most, even relying upon, and Judge Johnson, you asked about this, the record as is doesn't have much because it's left over from back then, but there's nothing that rises to the level of affirmative misconduct and malfeasance, knowingly, intentionally lying. Plus, what benefit would that be for an individual county worker? The key here then is using generic concepts of equity and due process is inappropriate here, where the more refined area of law is equitable estoppel. If the court analyzes this case under those principles from equitable estoppel, which is what the trial court did, it estopped the government. It didn't call it that, but it did that. This court should apply that law correctly. And I think what this panel should do is ask respondent, what's the legal theory? Where's the law that allows this? The only decision that a respondent can point to is that one Massachusetts case that Your Honor pointed to, which did not analyze equitable estoppel.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Laura Signet, and I represent the estate of Raymond Trahan and Lisa Evert, the personal representative of the estate. Federal and state law provides that the state should attempt to recover medical assistance benefits correctly paid under certain circumstances. The estate has never and does not now dispute that. The question presented here is whether Rice County should recover in this particular case. And the answer is no for two reasons. Number one is the lack of notice and due process. The district court found that Rice County failed to provide notices that are required under federal law, and that failure was exacerbated by misleading information provided to Mr. Trahan by the county social worker. Secondly, the county has failed to adequately explain or prove by a preponderance of evidence.
Counsel, could I interrupt you? So, counsel for appellant, we don't see you on the screen. Could you please turn on your camera and keep it on just so that we can see you throughout the arguments of both parties?
Sure. Thank my you. Apologies, Your Honor. I didn't realize the camera being on was something the court required. Thank you.
Okay. No problem. Thank you. Ms. Sidnett, I'm sorry, but you were at number two, I believe.
Thank you, Your Honor. The second reason that the court should be affirmed is that the county failed to adequately explain or prove the accuracy of the 19 pages of numbers and codes by a preponderance of the evidence. And in fact, the county failed and refused to respond to the estate's legitimate questions regarding that printout. Because the district court's denial of Rice County's petition for allowance of its claim is well supported by the evidence in the record and the law, the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the county's petition for allowance, and the estate would ask this court to affirm. With regard to the notice and due process issues, it is significant that Rice County fails in its briefing to this court to refute the district court's findings of a lack of notice. Instead, the county argues that the personal representative lacked standing to argue an infringement of Mr. Trahan's due process rights.
Excuse me, but it seems as though the county is arguing now that you don't need to give notice, that there's no penalty. Would you address that?
Well, contrary to the county's argument that this is a generic notice and equitable conclusion by the district court, failure to provide adequate and specific notice as a violation of the Federal Medicaid Act is quite specific. And as pointed out by, as Judge Johnson has already alluded to, by the manager of the Department of Human Services Benefit Recovery Section for the Department of Human Services, in her affidavit, which is document 63, exhibit 3, paragraph 9, she specifically states that the state is required to comply with those regulations and policy guidance provided by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid.
So what is the penalty if you don't?
That they do not recover. And the Massachusetts court held just that. I would also note in other circumstances, there is a Sciola case cited by the estate in our briefing from the appellate court in Colorado that also disapproved recovery by the state in circumstances where they failed to provide a different notice, but a notice alerting beneficiaries of an estate that they had the right to request a hardship waiver. In the face of a claim for estate recovery.
Counsel, can you remind me, in the Massachusetts case, my recollection is that it wasn't based on a constitutional due process argument, but was more based on a statutory interpretation and interpretation of the legal manual as to what the government was required to do in order to correctly in order to receive payments. Am I recalling that case correctly?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Massachusetts court specifically acknowledged that the notice that the state Medicaid manual requires is particularly important because recovery of capitation payments can be far in excess of any services that the individual Medicaid recipient may receive. And in fact, it can recover capitation rates when there were no services provided. So it is an appropriate safeguard that notice is in place, and denying the county's recovery when they fail to give that required notice is an appropriate remedy.
Did you argue to the district court the, you know, more statutory interpretation argument? Because, I mean, when I read the district court's order, it really does rely on sort of principles of constitutional due process as opposed to, a straightforward statutory interpretation of what notice is required under the statute.
I would agree that in general that the district court is referring to due process and equity issues, but clearly calls out the failure of the specific notices required by the state Medicaid manual. The first being that participants are to be informed of the estate recovery program generally when they first apply for the program. And the second and more important here is the specific notice with regard to capitation payments before they are enrolled in a managed care organization. So I understand, Judge Larson, your point in terms of the language used by the district court, but she did very clearly identify those statutory failings by Rice County. With regard to the standing argument that the county raises, that the personal representative cannot litigate infringement of the rights of the decedent, the personal representative of Mr. Trahan's estate meets every element of the exception recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Powers decision, which is cited in our briefing, in that the estate suffered a concrete injury in fact. The estate and its personal representative are closely related to the decedent, and there is a hindrance to Mr. Trahan asserting his own rights in this case because he is deceased. Disallowance of the claim by the district court also does not fall within the gamut of equitable estoppel here, because the county failed to provide the statutory notice. You cannot argue that Mr. Trahan relied on or changed his position in reliance on a notice he was not provided with. The only piece of that puzzle of where the information was not provided or where misinformation was provided that could be fit into an equitable estoppel argument is the misleading information provided by the social worker. And the estate would concede that that information by itself, the social worker's conduct by itself, would not rise to a level of malfeasance to warrant the imposition of equitable estoppel. But here, you have the statutory failure to provide required notices, and that failure is exposed to harsh light in light of the fact that the only information Mr. Trahan was given was the misinformation provided by the social worker. Again, we are not asserting that the social worker acted with malintent, or even that she intentionally misled him or understood that the information she was providing was wrong. But the failure of the notice requirements is fatal to the state's recovery.
Ms. Zidnek, I wonder if you can help me understand the background a little bit. So in the letters from the auditors concerning the capitation rates, there's a reference to fee for service. I should find this. There's a sentence in the first paragraph. We understand DHS will also recover against assets based on certain services utilized in the fee-for-service Medicaid, FFS, Medicaid environment, which is outside the scope of this letter. That suggests to me that either DHS or the county or both has the option to seek reimbursement either under a fee-for-service arrangement or capitation arrangement. I don't know. I'm supposing a little bit here, but I'm wondering if you can educate me more on that. And if so, you know, who can make the choice and what are the circumstances when the government agency makes the choice and so on?
Thank you, Your Honor. In fact, the state can recover both. So there are cases that have not reached the appellate court level, but that have been argued in district courts around the state of Minnesota.
Can I stop you? Do you mean either, or could they do both at the same time?
Both at the same time. So the state can recover the fee for service, the actual services provided. In this case, we have very nominal housekeeping, home-delivered meals, and occasional medication setups. Those specific fees could be recovered in addition to the capitation payments made to the managed care provider. That's part of the system. And
can I stop you again and forgive me for interrupting, but I want to hear everything you have to say on this. Is it also true that the government agency must recover both, or does it have can it make a choice or an election to seek one or the other?
The state has the option under its state plan to seek recovery of some or all of the capitation payments. And I emphasize, Your Honor, forgive me, I emphasize seek recovery. It is not a per se recovery that if they follow the basic civil procedure rules that they are automatically guaranteed full recovery. But they can, and Minnesota's state plan provides for recovery of an actuarially determined, I have difficulty saying that, much less understanding what that means, but an actuarially determined portion of the capitation rate that it's paid to managed care organizations based on the demographic of the specific population being served. In Mr. Trahan's case, people over the age of 65 who are receiving long-term services and supports in a community-based setting, in his case, in his own home. So the Milliman letters that were provided 3 years after the estate denied Rice County's claim, that was the first indication that capitation payments were part of this claim, specify the percentage or the amount of the total capitation payment that can be pursued as recovery under Minnesota's state plan. And I realize that that was a somewhat verbose response, Your Honor. I'm hoping it was somewhat responsive to your question.
Well, it was helpful. And I guess in addition, I'm wondering, so let's go back to 2010. My recollection, and I'm relying somewhat on the first appeal, is that it seems that in 2010, the Trahan family was thinking in terms of fee-for-services as the, and whether or not the, you know, the cost of the particular services actually offered, delivered, would be recovered, and the affidavits of family members show that they understood it would not. And I'm wondering if, and this is a little bit of a hypothetical, but whether at that time in 2010, was it an option for either for the county to basically charge the estate in that manner rather than capitation, or was the form of or I guess the method of calculating the amount of the recovery predetermined by law, so there was no option or election to be made by anyone?
I don't believe that there is an option or election on the part of the county at that level, Your Honor. I think those determinations are made by the Department of Human Services, incorporated into the state plan that is presented to and has to be approved by CMS. So I don't believe that that was an option at that point, but again, it was 3 years after the claim was denied before the estate was ever informed or the district court was ever informed that capitation rates compiled. And in this case, in fact, the majority, if not all, of the claim for recovery. I see that my time is ended. May I offer just a conclusion?
Yes, you may. You may sum up.
We're asking this court to affirm the district court's denial of the county's petition for allowance of its claim. The effect of denial is not to open the floodgates of posthumous litigation, which has been asserted by the county, but instead should require and encourage Rice County to conduct its responsibilities as an arm of the Department of Human Services in compliance with federal law. Affirming the county means that the county will not recover, affirming the district court means that the county will not recover up to 50% of what they take in, but not affirming allows them to continue their failures, and their failures in providing notice, their failures in approving individuals for programs that require a nursing facility level of care. And those failures risk loss of federal funding for the entire estate. And I would argue that that, in fact, is the raid on the public treasury as opposed to any estoppel that the county argues. Finally, Rice County has had ample opportunity and time to prove and explain what is included in this 19 pages of claims, and they have failed to do that. The county's briefing itself demonstrates a lack of understanding of the information in the claims history. So because the district court's denial is fully supported by the facts and the law, and there is no abuse of discretion, we would respectfully ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Idnick. Mr. McCarthy, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to respondents' argument that this is not a floodgates concern, I point out the fact that the attachments in appellant's addendum, the pages of the actual payments made for medical assistance, that's the identical information that comes only from one source. There's one system that DHS monitors that tracks that, and every single medical assistance claim in the state uses that information. That means on a yearly basis, approximately $40 to $50 million of medical assistance estate recovery dollars plus all the medical assistance fraud cases, plus all the provider fraud cases, plus all the subrogation cases. All of those cases rely on the identical printouts, the exact same information from the same area. This is a floodgates concern. And contrary to counsel's arguments, the Trahan decision has already come up in cases in district court in Hennepin County. It's my understanding it's also been raised in Ramsey County, and it's starting to percolate among other counties. That's in the short time that it's been out there as a district court order only. I would urge this panel to get the right law to apply equitable estoppel as your starting point of analysis. I'd also ask this court, again, you asked directly, where does it say, what's the penalty if an employee makes a mistake, if the government, you know, makes a mistake in some portion of it?
Mr. McCarthy, can I go back? So yeah. To your prior argument, you want us to apply the law of equitable estoppel. And do you want us to not apply federal statutory law about the Medicaid program and the state statute about the MA program?
Your Honor, the court should do both. The court is required to do both. The state's, the federal law says, hey, you're supposed to do these things.
Okay, so let's say we agree with you that the county is not equitably estopped from anything. Then how do you want us to analyze the federal statutory and state statutory issues? I'm not sure if you've fully addressed those issues.
The key here is the court needs to start with equitable estoppel. And as part of that analysis, this court can factor in. There's a federal requirement of certain things or certain steps have to be followed. That's one factor, but that's not the full analysis.
Let me just be clear. I'm not accepting your premise that the doctrine of equitable estoppel applies. It has not been. But anyway, but let's just set that aside. So if you're asked to, you're responding, I mean, if you're, the district court relied upon federal statutes, state statutes, and the state Medicaid manual, which is issued by CMS, a federal agency, looking with blinders on only at those legal sources, did the district court err in this case?
Yes.
Okay, and why?
Because the actual application forms themselves include the capitation language. Because in 2015,
okay, where is that in the application form? Is that, are you referring to that blank application form from 2010?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes, that's my understanding where it's contained.
And I've seen that. I don't think it says anything about capitation payments. It talks about a state recovery. I'm trying to find it now on my computer, but I don't think it says anything about capitation.
And Your Honor, my understanding is that, as I said earlier in my argument in chief, this is a well-established area of statutory and decisional law. It's my understanding that in approximately, it's gone through a couple of major revisions, major statutory revisions. And in fact, in response to the court's direct question here, it's my understanding that in 2015, another statutory revision came out. DHS sent letters to every single recipient of managed care that included capitation warning language, including the decedent in this case.
Is that in the record?
No, Your Honor, but Your Honor asked about it, so I'm providing that answer.
Okay. I mean, I have found that it's in an addendum or at the end of the application form, there's a reference to a state recovery. It's at, I don't know the exhibit number. Anyway, I apologize. You may continue. You have 10 seconds left, according to our clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'll agree. The record here is scant. But again, that's a factor. That's not the sole thing you make your decision on. If you apply the applicable law and factor that as part of the analysis, the other factors are the government's doing what the government is legislatively mandated to do, and the presumption of regularity. What the court would be doing by affirming the lower court's decision is encouraging hearsay affidavits used to collaterally attack decision-making from prior in a person's life in order to try to hang on to more money to open the floodgates and raid the public treasury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion.